Yedichakin taping for the Jewish Historical Society of Delaware, May 22nd, 2002. Sonny, what is your given name?
My given name is Noah.
Noah what?
Noah was really, you want to know something? I'm not even sure on my birth certificate whether I have a middle name or not.
And your last name is?
Schutzman.
Would you spell it?
Absolutely. S-C-H-U-T-Z-M-A-N.
And you were born when?
July the 23rd, 1920.
So, now that you are in the eighth decade of your life, you have a timeline that's long enough that you can share with us. So let's start, where were you born?
I was born right here in Wilmington.
Wilmington, Delaware.
Wilmington, Delaware.
And your parents?
Parents, Isidore Schutzman and Ida Schutzman.
Were they immigrants?
Dad was. Dad came over, I think, when he was around 13 or 14.
From?
From Poland or Hungary. I mean, it was really, it's a question of who had it at the time.
Uh-huh. And your mother was?
Mother was born in Philadelphia.
And was she from an immigrant family?
Oh, sure.
And where was she from?
Her family. Her family was from Russia.
Uh-huh. And so why did they?
It was interesting that her family, her father was, her maiden name was Goldman. He came over and had, I think, something like seven brothers, never spoke to any one of them. And she always used to joke about the thing with all the Goldmans around all over the United States. I mean, there might be some who are her uncles, but it was just one of
And why did she not speak to them?
Oh, why he did, not
oh,
her.
Oh.
No, it was her father, for whatever the reason, not that he didn't, but they just had no communication.
Uh-huh.
So she never knew a single uncle on her father's side.
Uh-huh. So she had, that part of her family was cut off.
Right.
Right. So they, your father came to Wilmington.
He didn't come to Wilmington. He came to New York. He was about 13 or 14 years old, came by himself. His uncle was in the window cleaning business, so naturally he came with a couple of dollars and went to work with his uncle in the window cleaning
business. New York?
In New York.
Uh-huh. And how did he get here?
Well, he stayed there for a few years, and then he went up to, I think it was Syracuse, someplace around there, and I think when he was around 18, he had saved up a few hundred dollars and found that there was a business, a window cleaning business here in Wilmington. And he came down and bought that window cleaning business, a small little business here in Wilmington, and that's how he came to Wilmington.
Huh. And so that was
His business was window cleaning.
Uh-huh.
And then, like everybody, you know, came over as it went along. When they were first married, naturally he bought the house. He could never believe in renting. And then as things went along, he bought another small piece of real estate, and had several pieces of real estate in addition to his business.
So he had a degree of prosperity for immigrants.
For immigrants, yes. In other words, he certainly did that.
Yeah. And you were the eldest of how many children?
There were three children. I was the oldest, and I have a sister who is 4.5 years younger than I am, and a brother who is 6 years younger than I am. That's Evelyn and Buddy.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in Wilmington and being Jewish?
It's funny when you phrase the question that way. Being Jewish, I can't remember a single incident of what one would call anti-Semitism. Nobody called me any names or anything like that. when I came into the family, mother and dad had a house on 2620 West Street, and that's where I grew up. And then when I was about 8 years old, we moved to 2303 Franklin Street. And when I look back on childhood, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed school, I enjoyed people, I was interested in athletics, and when I look back, I had a wonderful childhood. Mm.
So you didn't, because you grew up in the 20s and
right.
30s, and anti-Semitism was rife here.
When you say it was, but I'm speaking on a personal basis, I never had.
And so you felt as though there was no
the fact that
resonance.
I was Jewish and I went to Hebrew school, to Beth Shalom, naturally I did that, but as far as feeling like an outsider or looked down upon or the normal slurs that we know about 100 other different people, I personally never felt any of it at all.
Mm. So your friends were Jews and non-Jews?
That is exactly right.
Were you did you participate in social activities with the non-Jews?
When you say social activities, normally you think in terms of dating, you know, when you get
fraternities, sororities.
I never joined a high school fraternity, and all just occurred to me right now. In fact, I never dated. My first date was when I went to college.
Mm.
And at that time, I was 17 when I went to the University of Delaware.
Yeah.
And that's where I had my first date.
So you went to P.S. DuPont?
I went to Wilmington High for one term, and then P.S. DuPont was built. And I always joke about it, when P.S. DuPont was built, Dad had the job there of cleaning the windows from the contractor, and this was during the summer. So he had to hire a lot of extra help, and I was with him. So literally, I spent a week with Dad and the men there and really helped clean the windows at P.S. DuPont.
So you knew what it looked like before you went.
That is exactly right.
And then you went to the university. What
right.
year?
I graduated P.S. DuPont in 37. Graduated Delaware in 41, so I went in 37.
Okay, and what did you take at Delaware?
When I went to Delaware, I took a pre-med course. I was thinking in terms of being a doctor.
Uh-huh, and you didn't carry through with that?
Well, of course, you know, the normal things that happen, and that is what took place in 41. I was in ROTC, and when we graduated, instead of going to medical school, I joined the Army. I went in as a second lieutenant, and there you are.
You took
ROTC. Right, and the funny thing is, I took ROTC, and when I joined the Army, of all the, wherever I could have gone, actually what took place, I was placed in the 198th Delaware National Guard, which was an anti-aircraft unit.
So, you were sent. Where did you go during your Army career?
Oh, in the Army career, I went all over. I was in the Pacific for a year and a half.
You went right to the Pacific? No.
Well, no. I joined the Army in September of 41. And, of course, we all know war was declared. We became first part of the first expeditionary force to leave the country, and we left the country in January of 42. At the time, they thought that Hawaii was going to fall, and they were going to have to set up a refueling base for the Pacific Fleet. So we went to Bora Bora. And Bora Bora, you know, is the most beautiful island in the entire world. It really is. And we were there for about a year. Then we went to the New Hebrides. And after just about a year and a half there, I had your points, and I came back to the United States.
Mm.
And when I came back to the United States.
What year did you come back?
Came back in 43.
Mm. So the war was still on.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah.
Now, in other words.
So you didn't go, after that, you didn't go abroad anymore.
Oh yes, you know, as I came back in 1943, And I
from Bora Bora.
From from the New Hebrides.
Yeah.
Because after spending a year and a half there in the Pacific, came back in 43, the summer of 43, joined an outfit on Long Island, and had a wonderful time there, because every weekend we would go in to New York, and in those days, coming back, and you had been overseas, and you got a ribbon and all, and you go on 52nd Street, you couldn't buy a drink, do you understand what I mean? So we had a wonderful time also. And then what they were doing is, knowing what was going to take place, they were transferring a lot of officers into the infantry. Mm. And I went down to Fort Benning and spent 6 weeks down there in training for the infantry, and then wound up in February of 45 and went to Europe. And I stayed in Europe until September of 45, when I came back.
At the end of the war.
At the end of the war.
Right. How did your Army life have some impact upon who you are today?
The Army itself, I don't know whether it did or not.
Or your experiences.
Well, let's put it this way, as I think back on the thing, when I got out of the service in 45, I knew that I would never put on the uniform again. I didn't want any parts of it.
Why?
I guess I'm one of these people, I have a great difficulty in taking orders. Mm. I can't stand anybody to give me orders. And of course, I don't care whether you're a colonel in the Army, you're still taking orders. But that whole thing just turned me off completely. Mm. And in fact, I literally don't have anything from the Army. You know, some people say their uniforms and their ribbons and things like that. I don't have a single thing. That was it.
Well, sometimes being in a war or being on an island or has transforming effects. That's why.
Well, let's put it this way. When I think back in terms of the 4 years I was in the Army, I can't say that that transformed me or put me. Of course, when I went to Israel in the Army, that was a whole different story.
Uh-huh.
And that had the greatest impact ever with me.
So you returned in 45.
Came back in 45.
And
this was in September. And the idea of then trying to apply to medical school, which I wouldn't be able to get into for another year. And I was now 25 years old. I decided to go into business. And Dad bought a bowling alley on the Governor Prince Boulevard, and I ran that bowling alley for 3 years' time.
And then, what did you do?
Well, of course, I'm sure you know, I mentioned the Israeli Army. In 1947, everybody knows, in November of 47, the United Nations declared that when Great Britain left, in fact, they were definitely leave in May of 48. And when that took place, what was then Palestine would be divided into two parts. Part of it would be given to the Jews for a country of their own, and the other part for the Arabs. And then, of course, all the problems, you know, started a little bit of a war. Everybody knew that all the five Arab nations were planning on not, they weren't accepting it, the Jews were. And the more I kept thinking about that, it suddenly really hit me hard that here we were, after 2,000 years, the Jews of the history of 2,000 years of being butchered, slaughtered, ostracized, looked down on, had absolutely, and here now, after 2,000 years, to have the opportunity of having their own country, it was just tremendous. And in spite of what I told you before as far as the Army, I realized that what I was just going to have to do is to join the Haganah.
Now, I just want to stop you before we're going to go on from there. But what you said you realized, did you have formal Jewish education that planted you? What was it in your past that affected the way you thought? Because despite the happiness of many people, not many people went abroad to do what you did.
Well, when you phrase the question that way, as far as education, you know, I went to Beth Shalom, I went to Hebrew school, I was bar mitzvahed there, and I was confirmed there, and we had a regular Jewish family, a solid Jewish family, mother kept a kosher home, all of those sort of things. As far as being religious, in what we normally call a religious sense, I certainly didn't consider myself that religious. On the other hand, as far as being Jewish, I was always very, very, very proud of the fact that I'm a Jew. In fact, as an aside, I'll phrase it to you this way. You know, my sister and brother, I feel so bad, you know, both of them married out of the religion. And I feel so bad that they did. I have gotten so much out of being a Jew, and they evidently didn't have that feeling, and this is something that was just completely lost to them.
Well, that's why I'm asking you how you came to it, whereas your siblings didn't. And it's an interesting enigma.
It's a question, each person, I guess it's a question of what you're looking for in life.
Mm-hmm.
I read the Normal History, he said, what did the Beth Shalom gave this to me? I was just always proud of the fact that I was Jewish. and I just always was.
Uh-huh. Because you did, you were rather alone in Delaware.
Oh, as far as that's concerned, yes. I'm certainly the only person in Delaware that went over.
That's what I'm talking about.
But what it boiled down to was this. I'm having difficulty getting through to you. I had a great deal of difficulty getting to my mother and dad.
Mm-hmm.
When I told my mother and dad that I was planning on volunteering for the Haganah, they nearly fell through the floor. And how could you be so stupid? You were so fortunate. You were in the Army for 4 years, you were in the Pacific, you were in Europe, and you came back, and here you are. I mean, to go over there now, he literally couldn't understand it. Now, as far as being Jewish, Dad was as solid as can be, but he just didn't understand it. And I said, Dad, I've given it an awful lot of thought, and I can only tell you this. If I don't go now, I literally would not be able to live with myself. And that was really the essence of it right there.
Well, once you got there, you applied and you were accepted.
No, it was rather interesting. once I decided that that's what I wanted to do, I spoke to Mr. Coder, you know, from the Federation. It's funny, you know, me with names now in my memory.
Okay.
I know him as Mr. Coder.
Coder, he was the first director of the Jewish Federation of Delaware.
Right. And he was there. So I went to him and told him that what I wanted to do was to volunteer for the Haganah. How do I go about it? Where do I go? He said he wasn't quite sure. He gave me two organizations. He said to go to New York and they might be able to help you. He himself didn't know. So I went to New York, went to the first one. They really couldn't be of much help. Then I went to the other one and told them something and mentioned my background. And they said, I'll tell you what, go to this hotel, little hotel, I can't think of the name of it, on the 19th and Broadway there.
In New York City.
In New York City. And ask for so-and-so, I certainly don't remember the name. And they'll meet you there at 7 o'clock. So I went down there, and there were three fellows there, and we spent about 2 hours, and they interrogated me completely in terms of background and everything like that. And when they heard that I had a background for two, three years in any aircraft, that's when they got really interested. And
so your Army experience...
It was the Army experience.
That created their desire in having you.
This is exactly right. I mean, when they heard that, and then I found out later that what they knew, that Israel was expecting some anti-aircraft guns from Czechoslovakia. They had nobody there that knew anything about it. So when they heard that that was my background, 37 millimeter in the aircraft guns. It was literally a question, how quickly can you go?
Wow.
So I said, well, look, I've got a business. I've got to take care of that thing over there. And they told me, well, fine, let's see how quick you can do it. You'll have to get a passport. You'll have to get the visas. We'll take care of the plane and everything like that. And see what you can do as far as a reason to go, a business reason. So I went to, with names again now.
In Wilmington?
In Wilmington.
Well, what did he do?
Well, you know, when you asked me what did he do, he was president of the Federation, the two brothers now. Zalia.
Zalia.
Yeah, I went over and saw Sol Zalia and told him what I was planning on doing. So he said, fine. So he gave me all the papers, and I became his official sales rep in Europe. They did business over there. So
the Zalias had what kind of...
They had a unique business. They manufactured flexible joints for piping and in the oil business and things like that.
So this was really a ruse. You would have a legitimate
right.
title.
So in other words, when I went to get a visa, I got a visa for England, for France, and I think Italy also, so I wasn't sure what would be done. And my reason was, it was a business reason, I was a sales rep for Zalia Brothers,
uh-huh.
and that was it.
Uh-huh.
So that was your whole story there. So then, actually what took place, I flew over. I found out afterwards that they were bringing in, there were a lot of people that were coming in from all over the world, but in most cases what they were doing for volunteers is they were getting them into France and getting them down to Marseille, and then when they had a few hundred or something like that, they would take them over by a boatload.
They entered.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was given the royal treatment strictly on the basis of the fact of the aircraft.
Mm.
So I flew into Paris, and
did you have any fear or trepidation?
Fear of what?
Well, you were doing this without other friends or other people accompanying you.
Oh my goodness!
You were going into war.
Well, I'd be perfectly honest with you, that aspect of it
never came.
It just never even occurred to me. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do, and that was it. So in essence, what took place, I flew into Paris and went to the embassy. In fact, I think on my passport, I think I'm the seventh or eighth person on my passport at the embassy. This was from Israel. It was then a country. This was in June. They had declared the country, you know, in May. And
so you were the seventh or eighth person that applied for entry?
No. They came into the embassy in Paris.
Oh, in Paris.
That was
to go to Israel.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And I was there for 3 days. Had a wonderful time in Paris, you can imagine. And got on the regular plane, a Pan Am plane. They had to stop in Nice. They were having some problems. And to make a long story short, spent a night there in Nice, and then we left at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the plane was fixed up. We stopped in Athens, in Athens, knowing that we were going to Israel, they wouldn't let anybody off the plane, things of that kind. And to make a long story short, we finally flew into Israel, and of course, that was a moment I'll never forget, flying into Israel. And we flew into the Haifa airport. At that time, that's what they were using.
Why? It was the first time you had ever...
Oh, this is the first time I'd ever been to Israel.
Ever been to Israel.
And to be able to see Israel, it was now a country, and to fly in was just a moment that I'll never forget. It really was. And we landed there. There were two people who were there to meet me, and I'll never forget. We got into a jeep, and there we were at the airport, and it was a question of getting into Haifa, and we were stopped at a checkpoint, and it was rather interesting. Here are these two soldiers, in quote. One of them looked exactly like my Zeta, must have been 60 years old with a long flowing beard, with a Sten gun over his shoulder, and there he was at the checkpoint. And we went in, and I was with these two people. That first night, I slept at the Technion, on a cot there with a cot or so. And the next day, they took me over to camp to check in. Found out, when I went over, that they had still not gotten me any aircraft guns, and they wanted to know whether I wanted to wait. They wanted to know whether I wanted to wait until they got the guns before getting into the Army. I said, that's ridiculous. So naturally, I joined immediately and was put into the infantry. Two of them took me over to what was the Nesher Cement Works. That's right outside of Haifa. And the 72nd Battalion was stationed there. 72nd Battalion had just come back. They had just been decimated at the Battle of Latrun. And 50% of them were killed there in Latrun. And they
spell that.
What?
Spell.
Latrun?
Yes.
Latrun, L-A-T-R-U-N.
Okay.
That was the Battle of Latrun.
Okay.
And I came over there. This was sort of late in the afternoon. Met the battalion commander, chatted with him a while, and he told me that they were there trying to reorganize, to build up. They were trying to, their thoughts were, to make an all-English-speaking battalion of that, which is something that never happened. They never got enough of them for that.
But they weren't speaking Hebrew yet.
Who wasn't speaking Hebrew?
Israelis. They didn't start speaking Hebrew right away, did they?
Of course they did.
I thought
they always did that.
Well, in the beginning, there was the question of what language.
No.
That was earlier.
No. In fact, even when the people came, where you're talking there in the 40s now, when you talk in terms of the 20s and the 30s, they were speaking Hebrew.
They were. Okay.
Absolutely. The Ben Gurion, everything that took place there
was
in Hebrew.
Okay.
And what you're speaking about is in terms of whether it would be the official language.
Uh-huh.
And of course,
right.
There was no question about that.
Uh-huh.
But at all times, from the very, very beginning, Hebrew was the language of Israel.
Of the land.
Always was.
And how was your Hebrew?
My Hebrew was absolutely nil.
Non-existent.
Okay. I could say Brokator Denoy, and there we are. But anyway, what took place? I met with the battalion commander, and after chatting with him a while, he told me, he said, Norman, you'll be in charge of Company B, and you'll be the company commander there because of the background and all that. And he said, tomorrow, you'll get a chance to meet with them. So we had dinner then, and right after dinner, he gets a call from a regimental headquarters, and from what I gather, what took place was this. The 79th Battalion, which was a tank battalion, were going into to take this town, and our role was
They were going to take an Arab town?
That's correct.
Okay.
And our role, his role was that we were supposed to go out in case of a counterattack, we were to dig in and help them. Well, around 9:30, 10 o'clock, two Egged buses come over. My company, for the first time when I saw them, 60 men, there they were. I met the first sergeant for the first time, met the men for the first time. We had a total of 13 rifles, 3 pistols and a couple of hand grenades, and 2 Egged buses to take us out there, and our role was to dig in, and that would be it. Well, to make
now,
a long...
You knew how to use arms.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yes, because you had been... And did all these Israelis know how to use it also?
Oh, the 60...
Had they all been trained?
Well, trained in whatever way. Now,
yes.
The 60 that were there, that most of them were volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So when these weren't Israelis, they weren't born there, all of them were volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
That had been there. And what took place, thank goodness, there wasn't any problem in taking the town. In fact, the shot wasn't even fired. And things went very, very well there. To make things move along real quickly, about several weeks later, a large shipment of people came in, volunteers came in from Marseille, and joined with the battalion there. There was enough to build up our company to full strength of 120 men, and it was an all-English-speaking company. The other companies were not. One of them was mainly Yiddish-speaking. The other was whatever, but they never had enough for an all-English-speaking battalion.
But yours was?
Mine was a company.
Company.
Notice, I had Company B, 72nd Battalion, 7th Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this 7th Brigade is the elite today, is the elite brigade in the entire Army. This is the brigade. Of course, when I was there, it was infantry, the 7th Brigade. Later on, a couple of years later, it was switched over into tanks.
Mm.
And, the 56th War, this was the brigade that went through the Suez. In the 67th War, this is the brigade that took the entire going up on the thing in terms of going into the West Bank and all.
So, actually, you were the first commander of that brigade.
No, you mean Company B?
Company B.
No, the one who had been company commander was killed on Latrun, and I then took over the company.
Mm.
So then it was a question of training and getting not only my company, but the battalion. We were into training to really get a fighting force operating properly.
But yours was anti-aircraft.
Oh yeah, well, that's been my experience, but of course I've been trained at Fort Benning in terms of infantry.
Uh-huh.
So
you were not going to be using it.
Oh my goodness, no.
Okay.
Fact is, they never did get the aircraft.
Oh, they never come.
They never did get them in.
So you changed your mission.
Right. See what is taking place. This is a month after the state was established. Their training was really rough. The people went in into battle with very little training. Some of the Palmach was a little bit different. So there was not just the company, but the entire brigade was in a training mode. And in fact, our first battle was about a month and a half later. It was, we were supposed to take a hill near Acre. And that was our first battle in taking that.
Did it?
I was chatting before about the town that we were supposed to help there, and that was Nazareth, and the Nazareth was taken without firing a shot, literally. And I was mentioning to you the fact that in our first battle, there was a town, a hillside, must have been 10, 15 miles to the east of Acre. And our role, what took place, is that the Arabs were on the top of the hill, and this was supposedly during a ceasefire, and the army decided that it had to be taken, and our role was to take that hill. When I say hill, I mean it overlooked the entire town there. And we went there, we were taken again with agate buses that we got fairly near there. During the day, there was nothing over there at all, and we set in position. It's just to tell them aside, I'll never forget, we had one of the soldiers there who was 18 years old, had no real background whatsoever.
He was an Israeli.
No, he's not an Israeli. There were no Israelis in my company.
Oh.
In my company, everybody, 120 men, they were either American, Canadian, English, or South Africa.
I don't think he mentioned that before.
I didn't?
No.
All right. So that in my company, as I said, it was the only all-English-speaking company. American, Canadian, English, and South African. The only two Israelis that were in I had two lieutenants, both of them were sabres, and I'll tell you a story about one of them afterwards, but they each had a platoon, and I had two other, one from South Africa, one from Canada, were platoon commanders, they were lieutenants also. And of course my executive officer was Basil Sherman, he was from Britain. And this was the company that I had, but it was all English speaking.
And was there anyone there who was not Jewish?
In my company, no, they were all Jewish. When you ask the question, let's put it this way, Macha, which is the name
of... How do you spell it?
Macha would be M-A-C-H-A-L. Macha is a word that they use for volunteers. In fact, if you go to Israel even today, and you use the word Macha, it isn't a word per se. It stood for the volunteers, foreign volunteers, who joined the army over there. And that's basically what it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, now your company is operating.
It's operating. And I started to mention, they were some of them, and I would say, with only a few exceptions, all of them had some experience in armies, whether it was Canadian, South African, or whatever. It was just a cross-section, and they had all different kinds of backgrounds. All of them didn't have good solid training, but some of them, they certainly did. One of them, and I'm just thinking of this right now, an 18-year-old kid from the United States, and like a typical 18-year-old kid, when we were training, I can remember him actually using things, terrible things. I can't wait till I get myself an arrow. And, you know, just gung-ho and everything like that. When the time came that we went up, what took place is, this was at night, we started to go up the hills there, and went up there, and we were fired on over there. This was the middle of the night. Everybody was down. We started to crawl forward, and to make a long story short, we finally went ahead and took the thing. And what took place there is that night, I guess it must have been around 1 o'clock in the morning, when we had taken the entire hill, our own men were in position over there, and that was it.
You didn't lose anyone.
At that point, we didn't lose anyone because there was just a couple of shots or something like that, and the Arabs usually didn't like to fight at night anyway. So that night, we took the hill, and I got all the men placed in position around the hill. When daybreak started, that's when their fire opened up from Arabs all around. And when I had set the thing all up, we had three of the platoons forward, all set up. One platoon in the back for what's called in case.
Cover.
That's right. So what took place when the fire started, and it was heavy, and Arabs started to come through, I, what it called, had a runner go back to the platoon that was in reserve and told them, we're under heavy fire from the Arabs over here, come forward. Now what took place, he had his men fix bayonets and literally ran forward to join with us. It was the only bayonet charge in the Israeli army, and it's a matter of record that was there. And we were able to sweep through, get all of them. We lost three men over there. Now I was speaking about the one person couldn't wait till he got himself an Arab. In the middle of all of that, I didn't find out until afterwards, he literally went stark raving mad, started hollering, ran down the hill behind. The wind-up was, he wound up in the hospital for a few months. He was shipped back to the United States, and that's the way things go.
You had never had any command experiences where you had actually commanded a group?
Oh, yes. In other words...
You were in the United States Army, were you the commander?
I was a platoon commander.
You were?
I was a platoon commander.
So you had already had this kind of experience.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Because I thought this was the first time that you used these talents.
No, no, no. In other words, I was always as a platoon commander.
Uh-huh.
So you have that. Now, what I didn't, I hadn't been under fire before in either of the other two theaters. So this is the first time I was under fire. But as far as being a commander, I was a platoon commander in the aircraft, and the same thing in infantry when I was in Europe.
Well, what's the difference being under fire?
All the difference in the world. All the difference in the world. But it's a question, you do the best you can with what you've got.
Yeah. It's a humbling kind of thing.
Again, it's a question that when you face in all of life, you do, you're trained in whatever it is that you're doing, that's your job.
So this kind of work that you did as a commander, how has it served you in later life?
Well, let's put it this way. Before we let me wrap up one other thing before I now take that. About 2 months later, we were given orders that we were going to take Meirun. Now, you've been there, you've been at Tzfat, and Meirun is the highest mountain in Israel itself. This is going to be part of a force that will sweep through the entire Galil. Now, Galil is G-A-L-I-L. Now, when it was divided by the United Nations, originally the upper Galil, it was going to be Aram. Tzfat was going to be Israeli. So what was going to take place, this was going to be to sweep through the Galil, take it. We went up at Tzfat, again with Agat buses and all that, and that night what took place is Count Bernadotte was killed. And because of that, for political reasons, we were all moved back. About 3 weeks later, we went back to go into the same thing. Now,
Bernadotte, I want you to spell Bernadotte.
Bernadotte, I guess, would be B-E-R-N-O-D-O-T-T-E.
I think N-A-D-O-T-T-E.
That was it.
Okay.
So this was the 7th Brigade who had the role of sweeping through the Galil. My own company, our role, was to take Meirun. Now,
where is Meirun?
Meirun, exactly. You know where Tzfat is.
Tzfat.
Tzfat, S-A-F-E-D.
Right.
S-A-F-E-D. Now, our role was to take Meirun. Meirun was
spell it?
Meirun, M-E-R-U-N.
Okay.
Meirun is the highest mountain there. At the base of it is a little town, Meirun. And at Meirun is Rabbi Shimon's grave, S-H-I-M-O-N. Now, our role was to take it. And what took place that night, and I'll tell an interesting story about this later on, but that night, about 9 o'clock, I had my company, and we went to the base of Tzfat, and we were going to have to go behind enemy lines so that we would be able to storm Meirun, which was up on the mountain there. And I was met there by a guide, and his role was going to guide us behind the enemy lines so that we would be in a position to take Meirun if daybreak there. We went behind enemy lines, and there was a little bridge there. They blew up the bridge to stop any counterattack. And then, just at daybreak, Rabbi Shimon's grave, incidentally, looks and is a fortress there. And I'm sure you've seen it together there right now. Anyway, we were at the base, and actually now it's all overgrown, but at that time, it was nothing but rocks.
And what year is this?
This is in 1948.
Okay.
This is all in 48.
Okay.
So this must have been in October now of October of 48.
Okay. Because we like some chronology.
Right. So this was at that time. So what took place, there was like a fortress there. We were under heavy fire, and it was a question of trying to get in there. What was normal in a thing like that, it was a question of using heavy fire on one place. We were able to get some of our men inside, and to make a long story short, we were able to sweep through and took the entire town.
Wow.
That was the May ruin. From there, it was a question, we went on to Jish, which had been taken by another outfit. We stayed there from Jish. Then we went up.
And what day, is this still the same month?
Oh yeah, in other words, this
it's
whole
one
thing.
One follows the other.
This battle I'm speaking about was a 3-day battle. A 3-day battle, and we went straight on through, hardly with any sleep whatsoever. So that first night, the next morning, we took May Ruin, we went ahead there to Jish, and then while we were staying there, then from there on one of the nights, the next night, we went up to the hills over Sasa, and we were there and swept through there. And when I say we, some of it was my own company, but of course it was our battalion that was taking there, and the rest of the brigade was working in other areas there. Make a long story short, in 2.5 days, 7th Brigade had swept through and taken the entire Galil right up to the Lebanese border. Now, at that point, I got orders to go up to the Lebanese, we were on the Lebanese border, and I think you've been there yet, got a string of mountains right along
right
there. And our role was to go up there, set our company in place. And
on the border.
On the border,